We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
what makes a life creative?
Are you born creative, or is creativity something that can be cultivated?
You are now about to enter the nerve center to the entire Wonka factory. Inside this room, all of my dreams become realities, and some of my realities become dreams.
What's the difference between a creative career and a creative life?
If you're a student who cares about creativity, should you focus or explore?
For, you know, 20 years at least, I've been saying that creativity is encouraged by questioning everything. And I guess you have a slogan here, which I did not realize.
Our guest is Scott Forstall, inventor of the iPhone and Tony Award-winning Broadway producer.
Recorded in front of a live audience of budding creatives at Stuyvesant High School in New York City.
The Creative Life, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
In this season of giving, we want you to know that we are grateful to you, our listeners.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk. Is creativity something you're born with?
Or can it be cultivated?
What can young people do to prepare themselves to live more creative lives?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Stuyvesant High School in New York, in front of an audience of New York City high school students and their parents.
And we're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the creative life.
Ah, the creative life. That sounds fantastic, man. I wish I had one of those.
Josh, come on. Don't be so modest. Come on, you write about literature and philosophy. Surely, that's got to be creative in and of itself.
Look, writing novels, that would be creative. Or poetry. And trust me, Ken, you do not want to read my poetry.
Oh, come on, it can't be that bad.
Oh, yeah, it reminded me to show you my ode to a toenail clipping.
If you really want to be a better poet, you want to be more creative, well, why don't you do something about it? Go over to the English department and take a creative writing class or something, for example.
Yeah, but I just don't think it's that easy. I mean, look, okay, if someone's already creative, then a class can help them. It can sharpen their skills and so on. But if you're like me and you don't have a creative bone in your body, then I'm afraid there's not much hope for you.
Wow. I'm shocked, man. You've got such a fixed mindset. No wonder you don't consider yourself creative. You got to change it up. You got to switch from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset, Josh.
No, I see what you're doing. You're channeling our good friend and colleague, Carol Dweck, the famous Stanford psychologist.
That's exactly what I'm doing, and I'm right to do that because Carol has shown that many qualities of mind that we might think are just fixed, they can actually be cultivated. And you know, Josh, it's a really bad idea to go around thinking that your character is just given by, I don't know, your DNA or your genes or something like that. Because if you think that way, you may just give up and, you know, you won't even work to do the work you need to get better, like at poetry, for instance.
All right, so let me get you straight. You're saying my fixed belief that I'm not creative, that's the reason my poetry's so bad? I mean, all I have to do is believe, like Tinkerbell and Peter Pan?
Well, okay, I'm not quite saying that. I'm not saying all you have to do is believe like Tinkerbell or Pinocchio. But you know, Josh, changing to a growth mindset, that would be a start at least. It might actually motivate you to try and become a better poet.
Can we change the subject from my terrible poetry?
No, you're the one who brought it up.
Yeah, all right. But okay, look, you seem to think that creativity is like self-discipline, right? It's something you can learn. Right? So maybe you start off a bit lazy, but with the right training, you can become a more focused person.
Well, I do think that. That's obviously right. You can't possibly disagree.
Yeah, I do disagree. I think creativity is more like brilliance. I mean, you can't train someone to be a genius. Either they are or they aren't.
Look, I'm not denying that some people, or maybe they start out more naturally creative than others, you know, with a little bit more of this, Just as some people are, they're more naturally disciplined than others. But take any person, put them the right training, the right education, and they'll become better than they were when they started. That's why a growth mindset is so important, Josh.
So you think we could have something like a boot camp to make people more creative?
Now that you put it that way, I do. And you know what? The university, that's exactly what it is. It's a boot camp for creativity.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good slogan. And you know what that makes you and me?
What?
Drill sergeant to the mind.
There you go, Josh. Now you're getting it. And that's why we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to speak to some Stanford alums about how they continually foster creativity in their own lives. She files this report.
Tomiko Teal is an artist and a computer graphics pioneer. I like her definition.
I see creativity as being the life force that enables you to look at the world around you and say, what could be different? And how could I make those changes?
Teal comes from the kind of parents who had diverse interests and pursued many of them to the point of professional mastery. She describes the way creativity for her father was a way of being in the world, a more present and engaged and playful way. She remembers
going on walks with my father and him pointing out, look at this texture, look at how the slats of the fence create a rhythm as you're walking past them. And then he would say, oh, that's good, you know, down to the harbor, and he would just go onto a ship and down into the engine room. And as a kid, I'm going like, Dad, we're not supposed to be here.
But not everyone has such a joyful, fanciful relationship with the creative process.
The like survival mode where you just like get abandoned in a strange land and are forced to fend for yourself.
This is Jonathan Fettervorm, a graphic novelist who makes historical comic books.
I think that's the kind of creativity that I subscribe to, the sink or swim kind that brings out really fantastic results.
He's working on a book about the moon landing, and recently he got taken on this long digression into all this research about astrology and navigation by the stars, and he told me this panic had set in because he couldn't find a good way to use any of that research he'd spent all this time on in the book.
And it was one of these kind of like late night as I'm falling asleep modes that I kept going over the diaries that Kepler kept.
The astronomer Johannes Kepler kept these really intense diaries where he detailed why he was so inadequate and why he was never going to amount to anything.
In my own panic, I kept going over the words that Kepler was using to describe his own internal anxieties. And that was when I realized that I was fixating so much on this anxiety that Kepler is the perfect person to hinge this whole story on.
In other words, it was actually his own insecurity that led him to a compelling human narrative and character around which he could structure this astronomy lesson that he really wanted to give. Obstacles generate creativity, discomfort, dissonance, and the synthesis of disparate things. Tomiko Teal, the technologist and artist, she grew up in a time when being biracial was seen as a deficit. But from her parents,
we were told constantly, you're so lucky to have two entirely different cultures and worlds that you're intimate with, that you're a part of, that you can draw from.
Teal's professional work also synthesizes disparate ways of being. Early in her career, she pursued degrees in computer engineering and developed as a visual artist. At the time, these two fields were very distinct, even adversarial. But she questioned the idea that technology could be separate from questions of the human heart. And she also disagreed that so-called media arts were less than so-called fine arts. She brought together tools from both disciplines.
If you look at people who are considered to be creative, that's exactly what they're doing. They're putting together things that other people weren't putting together before.
For Jonathan Fettervorm, the graphic novelist, part of creativity is empathic. It's about not being locked in your own experience, but being open enough to discern other people's, even the people you think you know best. He tells me earlier that day, he and his 15-month-old son were walking in a hillside covered in fireweed, this dandelion-like flower.
And the cotton was getting caught up in the winds and swirling around in cyclones around us. At first he was scared, and then he was gleeful, and then he was just silent.
It takes a little creativity to share that experience with a baby, but if you can, then you've got
this mundane thing that I know and understand transforming into just a wonder of the universe.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that tour of the halls of creativity among our Stanford alums, Eliza. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. We're coming to you from Stuyvesant High School in New York City.
Our guest today is a man of many creative talents. I mean, he invented the iPhone and iPad when he was a senior vice president at Apple. And he's now a Broadway producer, best known for co-producing the Tony Award-winning shows Fun Home and Eclipsed. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Scott Forstall.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for doing this. So, Scott, creativity, you're clearly a very creative guy. I mean, you've had multiple creative careers. Now, on the surface, tech and the art and theater, they seem like really different things. Is there some common thread that unites them other than you?
Well, I'd say the disciplines, the fields are very, very different. But creating a Broadway show, this was a surprise to me. Creating a Broadway show is incredibly similar to creating a tech startup. I mean, in many ways.
Come on, give me one
word. Yeah,
well,
yeah,
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Well, both of them start with very creative individuals who start with whole cloth. They're looking to create a new product. And in the case of tech, it's maybe an application or a device. And in Broadway, it's creating a script. And so they start with this. They throw their heart and soul into it. They pull other people in to help run the show, to invest money, to invest, again, time and effort. And then at the end of the day, you present your product, be it a show or a tech product, to the world, and the people get to decide whether or not they're surprised and delighted by it.
Okay, but I mean, it sounds like you figured that out along the way, but was that your thought going in? You thought, hey, I know how to program computers. I guess I can produce a Broadway play. Why not? I mean, was that your mindset, or did this kind of sense of the connection
right.
evolve over time?
No, it was a total surprise. I mean, I knew that I loved theater. I did not know that I had any capacity to be successful there.
So you took a risk.
A huge risk. Yeah, I had no
idea.
Were
you scared? I mean, when did you first decide? You said, okay, I'm leaving Apple. It's time for a new career. I think I'll produce a Broadway play. How did that happen?
When Steve passed away and I decided I needed something else, I needed to go in a very different direction or something that would feel to me as a very different direction, I met a person who had produced Broadway shows. And we got along well, famously, and she started sending me scripts. And so I started reading scripts, and when I came across Fun Home, I thought, this is an important show. This is a show that deserves to be seen. It'll affect people in ways that only theater can. And so I dove into that.
So you dove into it.
Yeah.
You took a risk. I mean, did you have, were you like utterly confident? Were you afraid? I mean, what was your internal state? Because one of the things we heard about, risk have downsides, you know, and they have upsides. I mean, were you worried at all? Were you just like confident you could do this?
I think you always are taking risks. And if you're not taking risks, then you're not going to do anything interesting. I mean, literally, at Apple one time, Apple had been close to bankruptcy. And we'd come out with the iPod finally is selling okay, and we had the best selling unit-wise product in the history of the company, and then we came out with a Nano, and we knew we were gonna develop it, and we'd canceled the entire iPod mini line before we even shipped the new product, and it could have devastated the company. But we did it because we believed in it, and so we took risks. So it's about taking risks. That's the way you get to the next level.
I guess if you're not taking risks, you're taking a different kind of risk of wasting your life.
Yeah, exactly.
So is creativity born of repeated failure and then a success? Or is there like, you know, I take a risk because I'm so good at this, there's not really a risk. I mean, you know what I mean? How much is creativity born of, I tried out this, I tried out that, I tried out that?
So I don't think that creativity requires failure. But I think it requires the possibility of failure.
Right.
You have to be psychologically ready for that as a possibility.
Absolutely.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Stuyvesant High School in New York. Our guest is creator of the iPhone and Broadway producer, Scott Forstall.
So what exactly is creativity? Is it something you're born with, or can it be developed? And is the kind of creativity you need in tech the same as the kind you need in the arts?
Creativity, technology, and the arts, along with questions from our very creative audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks so much to our musical guests, Jazz at Stein. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Broadway producer and inventor of the iPhone, Scott Forstall. And we're thinking about the creative life.
Do you consider yourself to be a creative person? Are you hoping to have a creative career of invention and discovery? How are you preparing yourself for a life lived outside the box? Join the conversation by stepping up to one of the microphones in front of the stage.
So, Scott, in the opening, Scott, Josh and I disagreed a bit about how much creativity can be cultivated and how much is just a fixed trait. You know, you're born to with a certain degree of creativity. You either got it or you don't. So what do you think? Is creativity the kind of thing that can be cultivated and increased in a person?
Oh, absolutely. I believe it can be cultivated. I don't believe it's just an innate, you're born with a certain level of creativity. I think you can grow that over time.
So we could take Josh and make him a better poet.
I mean, I think for any given discipline, for any given area, there are certain skills you need, and it may be harder for some versus others. But I think in general, I think of creativity as a mindset.
Yeah, so let's talk more about what goes into that mindset. I mean, as an educator, I agree with you. I think creativity is the kind of thing that can be cultivated. I'm not sure our entire educational system is founded on the idea that we should cultivate creativity. I mean, take science. A colleague once said to me, you guys in philosophy, you're always teaching things you don't believe. You're always teaching your failures, and you're arguing with them. He said, in science, we don't have time to teach our failures. I said, wait a minute. If you don't have time to teach your failures, then you don't have time to teach the process of science. If you don't teach the process of science, how are you teaching about creating new science?
Because
a lot of possibility.
Right, a lot of what people do in the humanistic disciplines is, I mean, they're, you know, from a very early stage, they're invited and required to come up with their own solutions to problems. So that sounds like a way in which, I mean, does that go along with what you're saying, Scott? I mean, that creativity can be cultivated? Is it a matter of habit, getting into a habit?
Right, I think it is a habit. And I think certainly to your point, like, creativity can be squashed. I mean, when you have a new idea is like a very fragile life form, and a harsh word, an insult, can both crush that idea and the person who came up with it, their tendency to create creative ideas or vocalize creative ideas in the future. So I think you can hurt creativity. But for you know, 20 years at least, I've been saying that creativity is encouraged by questioning everything. And I guess you
that's
have
our
a slogan here, which I
don't
did
know
not
if
realize.
We stole it from you or you stole it from us.
So I think it's by questioning everything. And here I was actually inspired by my freshman year at Stanford. I took a psychology class from Philip Zimbardo. Now, for those of you who don't know, Zimbardo is, you know, one of the most famous psychologists who ran the Stanford prison experiment, where he took some students and made them prisoners and some guards, and immediately the guards became sadistic. Zimbardo's, you know, a great professor, but don't enroll
That's
in one of his
experiments.
That's
why we have human subject committees now.
Yeah. But I was taking this class with him, and he was talking about lucid dreaming. Now, lucid dreaming is the ability to wake up in your dream. You're still dreaming. I mean, you're still physically in REM. We can medically tell that, but you're aware and can control the dream. And it's something that I've done since I was a pretty young kid. For high school, it was really useful because when I was taking like French in like my junior year of high school, I couldn't remember vocabulary words. I'd look at them right before I went to bed. I'd go to bed. When I got into a dream, I'd wake up and I'd go to the chalkboard in the dream and I'd practice these vocabulary all night long. I'd wake up and I knew them.
Mais c'est formidable.
Oui. And so what happened in this psychology class, Zimbardo said you can actually learn to lucid dream. It's something I didn't think you'd possibly learn to do this thing other than sort of randomly the way it happened to me. And he said the way you do it is you constantly question whether or not you're awake or asleep. So you're questioning your reality as you go around all day long, every half hour. Am I awake or am I asleep? Am I awake or am I asleep? And you know, you're awake, you're
Sounds
awake.
Sounds like he's been reading Descartes. Exactly.
And eventually, you ask yourself, am I awake or asleep when you're asleep? And you recognize you're asleep.
So you
recognize this thing about you.
Let me ask you something, okay. So you said a harsh word can squash creativity.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe this is not true. But, you know, your former boss, Steve Jobs, had the reputation out in the world of being a brutally honest man. Yet Apple was surely one of the most innovative tech companies ever. I mean, the iPhone's the thing of beauty, So, I mean, how did that work at Apple? How did all that happen?
I think that when we were working on a given project on new features, we protected that bud of a new idea, and we were very careful about that. Certainly, if we got to a point where we decided an idea was not good, we would cut it. But at the moment that we considered whether or not this was worth doing, we 100% would support that. And you can actually create an environment to support creativity. So one thing I would do, actually, when we were working on Mac OS X, right before the iPhone, whenever a release was finished, I would actually give every single person in the department an entire month to do anything they wanted for a month, which is kind of insane because you're talking thousands of people, so millions of dollars of salary spent for a month for people to do whatever they wanted. And they would work so hard that month coming up with incredible ideas. In fact, one, at the end of it, they'd present these and some would get presented to me. And one I saw was this idea of a 10-foot user interface. And I loved it, and we turned it into Apple TV. Yeah. Apple TV was invented because someone was encouraged to do whatever they wanted for a month, and we turned it into a product. So you can have that kind of environment to support creativity.
Right. So I want to come back to something you were saying earlier about questioning everything. I mean, you know, we heard in the Roving Philosophical Report about the experience of being around a small child, and it made me think also of Baudelaire's line, a genius is childhood rediscovered at will.
Right.
So, but how do you do that? I mean, so, you know, one thought that occurred to me that might make a bridge almost between this and the theater is it started to sound a little bit like what Brecht was trying to do. You know, Brecht had this idea that if you have the kind of theater that keeps waking people up,
right,
with the breaking of the kind of jarring breaking of the fourth wall, you can kind of get people in a habit, a little bit like your lucid dreaming training.
Right.
You get people in the habit of saying, oh, I might be dreaming, I might be wrong about my experience. Does that seem plausible? Is that the kind of theater
exactly
you might be doing?
Exactly right. And what Brecht would do in the theater and make you question what was happening on stage and realize it's actually being staged.
Yeah.
If you question all the time what's around me, what are the limitations, what's the conventional wisdom,
right,
then you'll start to step outside of that conventional wisdom because you questioned it. Heidegger talks about this Heideggerian breakdown, right? And it's where when you don't even realize something's happening until it stops working, and then you realize it. I think by questioning everything, you're looking for those boundaries, and then you can go beyond it. And to one more point on yours, you know, yeah, a child doesn't know what they don't know, and so they come up with unique ideas. The very first text message I ever sent was on a prototype of the iPhone, because phones were so horrible about designing for sending text messages. I couldn't figure them out.
Right.
And so when we were designing for text messaging, it was done with ignorance, but we just designed it for what is the best possible solution, not affected by things
around.
So
you got into the head of a child. Like, well,
yeah,
why
absolutely.
Is it like this?
Absolutely.
So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the creative life in front of an audience at Stuyvesant High School in New York City. We've got a question from that audience. I'm going to start over here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Chapin. I'm a sophomore at Cobham High School. And going back to the ability and innate ability to be creative, do you believe that there's a sort of hybrid between what one is able to be brought up with and what one is able to cultivate? And can that be applied to risk, where there's one point where one person is able to take a mighty risk, where another, it may be too much or too little? So is there a point at which there's a meeting between these two thoughts that someone is brought up with this idea, and is there a point where that is too much and there's just the possibility is just not there for someone to take some risk?
Good question. What do you think? Is it like a disposition to risk-taking? Can you cultivate in somebody a disposition to risk-taking?
So I agree with your premise that I think there is a certain level that you're born with on risk-taking and sort of creativity. I think there's a nurturing piece, and I think there's a risk-taking piece there. I think that if you take too much risk too early and you're in an environment that doesn't support it at all, it can 100% hurt your creativity later. And I think that's a terrible thing, and it happens all the time. So I think the right way to do it is take these small, calculated risks all the time. You get used to it, and you get used to being right and wrong, but then you're no longer afraid to take bigger and bigger risks.
So I think you're onto something really important. I mean, one of the things When I was younger, I really loved philosophy, but I started out as an engineer, and I was interested in science. One of the things that bugged me a lot about science when I was young was that my science education was all about acquiring tools. The reason I loved the philosophy class is because they were threw you in there, and you were arguing, and you could be wrong, and this, that, and the other thing. It was the process. Well, I think taking risk without the tools is a recipe for disaster, right? If you don't have, like, the basic fundamentals. But one of the things I do think we need to do is inculcate earlier, as we're inculcating these tools, the creative use of these tools, right? And I just don't think our education system does nearly enough of that. What do you say?
I agree 100%. I mean, if I were to step over here and try to jam with your jazz band from here, it'd be horrible and embarrassing. I'd probably never play again. But if I started learning an instrument up to a point and got better and better, there'd be a time at which I could get up in front.
So that's acquiring the tool, right?
It's the tools. You have to have a skill set, and that skill set enables you to take more risks in that field.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Stephanie, and I'm from Rockville Center. And so my question surrounds the original idea. So you created the Broadway play, or did you see a script and you perfected it for Broadway?
I co-produced it. I was not the writer. Lisa Crone and Janine Tesori wrote the music and the lyrics.
Based on a book by Alison Bechtel
that's an autobiography.
So the original idea was one thing, and then it was evolved and evolved. So is that actually creativity, taking something and then evolving it, is there an original idea?
Right. So I think that's a great question, and I would say 100%. I mean, it started based on an actual life of Alison Bechtel. She wrote it into a graphic novel. I think that was a creative process. I think her drawings are creative. Then Lisa and Janine took it and turned it into this play. I mean, the same question could be said, was West Side Story creative? West Side Story was based on Romeo and Juliet, and so everyone says Romeo and Juliet, super creative, an amazing work of art. That was based on a poem from Italian literature.
Right.
So each one of these steps, I think, is definitely creative in a different way. And I believe that creativity is a scalar. It's not a yes or no. So it's a question of how creative and in what way. But I think all of those are examples of creativity.
Yeah, you could think it would be wrong to think. You could think that there is nothing new under the sun. Well, first, that's not true. So there are original acts of, like, creativity ex nihilo, but that's not mostly how creativity works, right? Mostly it's combining and recombining new things. Think of what Scott said earlier about the texting on the iPhone, right? Somebody had the idea of that this device, which is a phone, can be a camera. Cameras existed before.
Right. Phones existed.
Texting existed. But the brilliance of the smartphone is, like, I'm going to put all these things in one box. And somebody had the brilliance to see that although nobody was, like, demanding that, you guys must have known, or somebody must have figured out, that once you put it in the hands of the consumer, it would blow their mind. That, too, was an act of creativity. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And I mean, part of the way we did that was to figure out what we could build for ourselves that we would love. But sometimes it is the combination. I mean, if you look at, I don't know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, an amazing symphony. Every note in that symphony had been played before and had been played by those same instruments before. Just not exactly in that same timing. That combination is still creative. And so, yeah, we took together a capacitive touch screen and certain applications and a certain form factor. That itself, I mean, that combination was unique and new and creative.
And here's something else I want to stress before we get to some more questions, that when we talk about sort of original ideas, like, nobody has had that idea. That's one thing, and that's really powerful, especially if it's an impactful, powerful idea, if you're the first one to have it. But one of the things we need to cultivate in the young, I believe, is just the capacity to have thoughts that are new to them. Right. So that if some kid was toying around with a synthesizer or something and had never heard Beethoven before and thought up Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, I wouldn't say, oh, kid, you're just copying. No, I would be amazed. Right, because that's one of the things you want to inculcate in the young, the capacity to go beyond what they've seen and to take it,
Exactly.
So, welcome to Philosophy Talk, then. What's your comment or question?
Hello. So, my name is Serena, and I'm a senior at Montclair High School in Montclair, New Jersey. And so you guys keep on touching upon how K-12 education and just education in general doesn't kind of support creativity, so...
Doesn't do it enough.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't do it enough. So why do you think that is? Like, why isn't that fundamentally built into our education system?
Oh, I have a thought. Do you have a thought? Here's my thought. It's lots of reasons. One thing is that we mistakenly think that what the Apples and IBMs and General Motors and all that stuff, what they're looking for is merely people with tools rather than this risk-taking innovative thing. I don't know. I haven't asked Scott this thing, but I bet you that when he was at Apple, he was really looking for young people, middle-aged people with a spark of creativity and not just a set of tools. Is that right or wrong?
I totally agree that some people think their job is to have a skill set that is employable, and teachers think their job is to beat that into you. And what I found was there were people who would come out of incredible Ivy League universities, and they could write the best algorithm in their sleep. But they were not creative. And it's because they had been so narrowly focused for so long that they could do what they were told, but they couldn't think different, as we used to say. They couldn't think outside the box. And so I think there is a mismatch between what maybe some educators think and what we actually want in industry.
And it comes from good intentions, right? The roads to hell is paved with good intentions.
I think they see you know, these interesting tools, and they want to teach that. But, you know, when you're teaching someone to write and you teach them that five-paragraph essay, that is, you know, an ante for playing the game. You need to do that. But you shouldn't then crush them when they write a seven-paragraph unique essay.
Right. Some of it comes from good intentions. Some of it comes from fear, because people who question everything, they're pains in the rears. Students who Socrates. Are trained to question everything, wait a minute, where'd you get that result from, teach? Right? Especially if they don't really have the tools, but they have the tools and they question everything, they can be pains. But you know what? We'll take this up at greater length in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the creative life with Scott Forstall, inventor of the iPhone and a Tony Award-winning Broadway producer.
If you're a high school student thinking about college, should you be trying to focus on one major right away, or should you be trying to get the broadest education possible? Should you take things like philosophy classes if you want skills that are going to help you live a creative life?
We're coming to you from Stuyvesant High School in New York City. We'll take more questions from our audience of high school students and their parents when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks again to our live musical guests, Jazz at Stuy. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about the creative life. We've got lots of questions from the audience, so why don't we go this way, then that way. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I'm Justin. I'm from Southside High School on Long Island, and I'd like to profess that I'm creative. I don't know what the definition of creative is. It could span across many things, but I have trouble, as a lot of people do in all of the things that I do, because I'm interested in a lot of things, in coming up with ideas. Because ideas are the spark of creativity, is the new life form, as you put it, and coming up with them is extremely difficult. And I just want to know if you can practice that, if you can practice coming up with good ideas, and if you can culminate the ability to create new ideas.
I want to jump in here. You can practice coming up with ideas. Practicing coming up with good ideas, well, that's you probably can practice that. But the question is, how can you can't guarantee that an idea is good, right? That's just questioning everything. I think you have to become an expert, you have to study lots of different things, and you have to put your ideas to the test. How do you put your ideas to the test? Well, try to build something, try to convince somebody, try to get somebody else to come buy into the idea. I don't think creativity is just a solitary thing that you do all on your own. You do it by engaging in a world that's like going to push back on your ideas. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you have to make it a habit. And so you're saying you're trying to come up with new ideas in a given field. I think constantly be thinking, okay, little ideas in that field, bigger ideas in that field, writing them down, bouncing them, you know, with other people. I mean, I remember lots of late night talks in college in the hallway at 2 a.m. where you're throwing out, you know, these ideas that are different from what you've thought of before. Other people, they help guide you to something that maybe is more interesting, more creative than what you had in the first place. And that's certainly what we did at work, is we would get together and we brainstorm, and there's techniques and there's ways of brainstorming where you throw out every single idea you have. But I think practice, literally, when you wake up in the morning, write down like two different ideas that you had as you wake up every single day, and just make that a habit. I personally, some of my best thinking is done in the shower, which is terrible because I live in a drought-stricken state of California, and as someone who cares about the environment, it is why I have to write checks to offset my carbon emissions, because I know I take very long showers. And a lot of things, when I have a challenge, I'll get in the shower. And so when we were creating this new web browser, I needed a name for it. We needed a name for it. So we couldn't come up with one. I took a shower for like half an hour, and it's hot. And it's the isolation, it's the sound, it's the comfort, it's relaxing. And I came up with this name, Safari. And so these things, I absolutely would go get in the shower to think. And so you might find there's a place that you think better. There's a thing that you do that makes you more creative.
So that's the, like, you know, six habits of creative people. But I want to take you into our domain a little bit, the university. Because Josh said, if you're right, he and I are drill sergeants of the mind. And the university, I said, is a boot camp for creativity. Think about your own university education. What in your university education helped you become a more creative person? And what would you recommend that Josh and I do as educators to like encourage more creativity?
I think the most important thing for me in directing my life toward creativity was taking a wide set of classes in many different disciplines. When I got to college, I was certain I was going to be an electrical engineer. I was going to study EE. I set up my classes to be, you know, the right level, high level math and physics and that whole path. And I wanted to be an inventor too. I like love the idea of inventing, and anyone can be creative. And my grandfather, who's a farmer, used to go to the junkyard and come back with a mass of random things, weld them together, and build something which would help his job work easier. And he would then bring all the farmers from the neighboring county and beyond around to look at it so they could build the same thing. So there's creativity in all fields. So I got to college and said, I'm doing EE. My first quarter of freshman year, I took a class in philosophy from John Perry, who I think actually used to co-host
Philosophy Talk. Philosophy Talk was his creative idea.
So John Perry, I took this philosophy class from him, and I was blown away. I remember a few weeks into class sitting there and watching this epitome of a college professor with his, you know, beard and probably patches on his coat, standing there and deconstructing the greats of philosophy. And it changed the way I thought. It changed what I wanted to think about. It changed my studies. And so I went back after a few weeks of this class and said, I'm not doing EE. I'm going to take a lot more philosophy classes. Philosophy told me what to think. And then I took this psychology class. And I said, well, psychology tells me how people think. And then I took a linguistics class, and that told me how you communicate what you think. And so I made this major, and it was just created right as I got there, of those plus computer science. And computer science was the tool. And it was the tool that took all these other disciplines together to create products on it.
You didn't name that major.
Yeah. So the major is symbolic systems.
Which I direct.
Which Ken now direct.
This was not a plan.
And so literally, for me, taking philosophy and then taking this wide range completely changed the way I thought, what I took in college, and beyond. And so when we were doing things like creating the keyboard for the iPhone, it required all this multidisciplinary thought, it required AI, and I wouldn't have had that had I gone down this other path.
So that's really interesting, Scott, because, you know, there's a kind of debate between people who think college should be vocational and people who think college should be helping us to live fulfilling lives. You know, the kind of, there's that famous debate between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois in Reconstruction. How should we educate the college-age African-American folk? And you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, Washington thought vocational, and Du Bois said, no. You know, the true college will ever have but one goal, not to earn meat, but to know right. the end and aim of that life which meat nourishes. But it sounds like you're saying, actually, there's kind of a middle way here, right? It's not just you should take a bunch of courses so that you will live a happy and fulfilling life. It's so that you'll actually be, you know, you'll be more creative even in your professional life. That's
yeah,
about right?
Yes, I 100% believe you should take this very wide range of classes. And I think there's a number of reasons for it. You know, one is, when I got there, I thought I knew what I wanted to study, and I was wrong. So taking something outside of my realm, my field of interest at the time, led to what my career became. So that's one. Another is, we're talking about creativity here. And I think that a big aspect of creativity is tying together disparate ideas from disparate fields. And so unless you have equipped your toolbox with tools from all these different fields, you can't make those connections.
I want to see
and
if you...
One more thing, which I think is really important, and that is, in today's day and age, people are going to have multiple careers. So all of the high school students here are going to end up with multiple careers throughout your life. And so by taking all of these classes in many different fields, you'll be more adept at navigating this change in fields as you progress through your life. So it's super valuable in all those ways. I think the Great Recession did a huge disservice because people ended up, especially parents, ended up telling their kids they should turn universities into vocational schools. Right. And so kids come in thinking, I need a vocation, and they spend 4 years doing that. That is not where you'll make the biggest difference. If you're going to go to a four-year university, come out with a broad education, be an expert in a field in there, but be ready to move between fields.
And I want to add a reason for that. I agree with you, but I want to add a deep reason for that that is should be very alive to this generation. You did your PhD. You were working in AI stuff,
Masters
right?
in AI, yeah.
Masters in AI. AI is coming, right? I actually believe eventually computers will be able to do creative work. There's still a lot that they won't be able to do, big picture thinking, making our decisions about how to organize our society for us. But they're going to take over many, many things. And a human being that is not flexible and creative and innovative and constantly kind of remaking themselves, that human being will be maybe left behind in the economy that's coming. So you should prepare yourself to be a highly creative being. And that takes this de-siloing, as you called it, of knowledge. I wonder if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, I think AI is definitely coming. When I was doing AI, anytime we solved a problem, people said, that wasn't AI, that was just engineering. It's right. been solved. Now there's actually AI doing work. And there's great work out there, discovering cures for diseases faster. There's a lot of big data stuff. It's really great. I'm not so anthropocentric that I think AI won't be able to do even things like creativity at some point, although today it's terrible at it.
Right.
It's terrible, look especially at literature and poetry.
Yeah,
it's abysmal.
Awful.
But the hardest things to do are things that require the most creativity on the broadest scope.
Right.
And so the better prepared you are to pursue that sort of endeavor, the better you'll be prepared to have a number of careers in your lifetime.
And you can't, I think your message is, you can't be prepared for that with just a set of technical tools. I mean, I love STEM education, right? But STEM education can't just be about learning to do math. It's got to be lots more than that. And that's why I like the humanities, philosophy,
and
psychology.
Exactly. And as I was saying, like when I would hire people onto the iPhone project, onto the Mac OS X project, onto the iPad project, the people who were just STEM were not often the superstars. The superstars were people who had a very broad, very creative bent, and they'd studied literature, philosophy, psychology, all these other disciplines that made them exceptional, even at building a tech product. And outside of tech, there are so many disciplines that require this broad education.
So, Scott, on that note of stirring endorsement of what Josh and I do, I'm going to thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Our guest has been Scott Forstall. He invented the iPhone and the iPad. He's now a Broadway producer, best known for co-producing the Tony Award-winning shows Fun Home and Eclipse. So, Josh, are you feeling more creative?
Yeah, look, I love this idea that it's all about habits. I think you get out of your own way, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so much is about turning off the filter, you know? Take an improv class. Learn to get a little bit loose and stop, you know, just quiet those voices in your head telling you it's a bad idea.
Yeah, you're right, exactly. Improv theater is a great analogy. I now teach my classes as my small classes. Improvisational philosophy, and I have students improv, and I think it does make them think, hey, I can produce this, I can do something new. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, either here or on the radio, we'd love to hear from you. Email it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog. And now, someone who's living the creative life at Warp 10, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, a few years back, a new job came about called a creative. Mainly, your job was to say, it looks a lot better if you do it this way. Does it work better? I don't know, but it looks better. Which is why the thing on your desktop, where you throw things away, looks like a trash can. Layout, editing, music, animation, PowerPoint presentations, TED Talks, email blasts, all became creative. Now, I'm a writer myself. When the digital revolution came along, I was hired by a video game company, but they didn't quite know what a writer did, so I was called a content provider. That took the glamour right out of things. Writers, mainly guys, used to head for the big city to live in a hovel, have a painfully thin, insane girlfriend, a drinking problem, maybe even a heroin addiction, and get in fistfights with the sculptor down the hall. It was about who was the true artist, Picasso, Bergman, Giacometti, or Hart Crane. Then you'd either starve to death or get a job teaching art to freshmen at a junior college in Ohio. Those were your choices. After your death, the room in which you wrote your masterpieces might be preserved. When the digital revolution came along, the garage replaced the room as a place of invention. This is the room where Charles Dickens wrote Little Dorrit. This is the garage where they made the graphic user interface that fueled the new economy. Jane Austen's house and garden became so popular after she passed away, her admirers were having their ashes scattered there when they died. It got so bad the museum placed a ban on the practice. Tourists were ankle deep in fan cremains. And there's the plus and downside of art in a nutshell. Nowadays, nobody writes novels, unless you're Stephen King or J.K. Rowling. Not worth it. Ask yourself, can this novel become a 3D blockbuster and theme park? If the answer is no, do not quit your day job. In that regard, a writer in Ireland was recently awarded a university prize for her writing, and it turned out she was employed by the same university as a janitor. Good thing, too. The prize is only a bit over $11,000. Hang on to that day job, you artist, you. In America, creativity was something you did as a child on a rainy day. Finger painting helped with hand-eye coordination, but it's not what you do in the conference room after the age of, say, 32. Some jobs required creativity, advertising, for example, and before all that, artists and writers used to be subsidized by dukes or queens. Now we have venture capitalists and hedge funds. Good news for whiz-bang startups, bad news for Toys R Us. And good times for creatives these days, coming up with the faster ways to get emojis out into the viral playground, devising new emojis every day, emojis that may interlock like virtual Legos to create vast Twitter edifices that we can inhabit for Instagram selfies. Wow. Not only that, new algorithms guarantee that Amazon will ship before we even order. And while all that is happening, we're finding the time to think about consciousness, mortality, the rapture, stock options, and our LinkedIn resume. And we find the time and nerve to ask, Daddy, what's a career? What you have lost in the rise of the creative is the idea that creativity requires a lot of inner pain. Great art once meant suffering. You use blood for ink. Well, Microsoft Word cares nothing for your art or your soul, and nobody suffers to make apps. It's all just neat, cool, awesome ideas that never stop. Like a shark, if they stop moving, the entire digital edifice dies. So you can be an artist, that is, an alcoholic, selfish bastard who writes thick novels nobody reads, thick paintings everybody hates, thin plays only beloved by the French, and you're dead before you're 30 with only your drug dealer to mourn you. Or you can be a creative. Think of what you do as not having value, but added value, like an emoji or an animated gift, or, oh, look, a puppy. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford's Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tima Pamantuan. Special thanks to Rick Shaw, Fabia Ngundele, Mary Chung Silagi, and the Stanford Office of Undergraduate Admissions, as well as Matt Palazzo, Alan Wang, Julia Amorosa, and Amanda Piasecki at Stuyvesant High School here in New York City.
Thanks also to Sun Lee, Lisa Wang, Kathy McGuire, Anne McGuire, Marie Honan, Eduardo Torres, and our musical guests, Hyun Choi on trumpet, Derek Fang on tenor sax, Jessica Park on keyboard, Max Ma on guitar, Box Wu on bass, Jeremy Paniker on drum. Jazz at Sty.
The senior producer of Philosophy Talk is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. The technical director is Dan Brandon, and our marketing director is Cindy Prince-Baum.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University, and the partner is on our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.